So as we have seen, a lot of so-called coins go bust because the trust has left the system from there, which is not actually dissimilar to any financial system.
Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is The Transformation of Value, a place for asking questions about freedom, money, and creativity. Today, I'm joined by my friend, Anthony Lamb. Anthony is a serial entrepreneur working in IT in the finance industry. Anthony, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Cody. Glad to be here.
Tell me, man, what's your background? Where are you from originally?
So, I was born in Hong Kong, and my parents are both Chinese, and I was living in Hong Kong until I was 7, and then I moved to Australia. So I grew up in Australia, and basically went through school, university, and then worked there for a bit, and then I decided to move to Hong Kong. And then from then onwards, I did my postgrads in Hong Kong and worked around the world, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Started my own companies, and then I started an IT consultancy business that grew out of my freelancing work that I was doing while I was doing my postgrad thesis, and then started my long road on the startup world.
Yeah, yeah. And then, just briefly, your interest in Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, where did that come from?
So I have to thank my colleagues in my first job. So basically, I came across the Bitcoin paper back in 2009. So that was my first exposure to Bitcoin. So that was even before the Bitcoin pizza incident.
Yeah.
So that was quite a long time ago.
Yeah.
So back then, of course, having had some finance and economics training myself, I find that quite unbelievable. And quite frankly, I was quite skeptical on the whole crypto Bitcoin business. Or back then, it wasn't even called crypto. It was really just Bitcoin back then. Then basically, I ignored it for a few years until around 2015, the start of 2015, which is when Mt. Gox incident happened. So after that, by chance, I came across some friends and colleagues at my clients who reintroduced me to Bitcoin. And also, I think the fact that Ethereum was coming was also a factor into bringing me into this crypto world, because the idea of a global computer, so to speak, with the smart contracts of Ethereum was quite a draw. So from then onwards, I started dabbling into Bitcoin, Ethereum, Litecoin back then was a big player. And then, down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, interesting. So, but you've been maybe agnostic towards the different sort of ways of approaching this, right? Because obviously today, I mean, we can clearly see there's a difference between Bitcoin and everything else. But I mean, certainly if you go back to the early days, I mean, a lot of people saw the plurality, I guess you could say, of cryptos as kind of interesting and a marketplace of ideas. Mm. And it's unfortunate that came with also a lot of scams, a lot of rug pulls and things along the way. I mean, how have your views evolved over time towards the landscape, I guess, of cryptocurrencies?
So I think one thing that I think especially Bitcoin, but crypto in general, but especially Bitcoin has really reinforced my beliefs is I think the value of these cryptocurrencies lies in the trust that lies inside the networks themselves. So as we have seen, a lot of so-called coins go bust because the trust has left the system from there, which is not actually dissimilar to any financial system. So from there onwards, then from using that as a barometer, we can judge basically where Bitcoin stands compared to other cryptocurrencies. And which is why I'm a firm believer that Bitcoin, perhaps due to its first mover advantage, or perhaps other reasons, I'm not sure, it remains the premier cryptocurrency and will not be replaced.
Yeah, it's interesting that even though the white paper talks about removing trusted third parties, there is inherently a trust in the network that it's going to, the flywheel is going to keep going, that it's going, that the incentives are going to continue to work. And I mean, maybe trust technically can have a definition that is is sort of like faith, but there is trust in the mathematics and the proof of work mechanism in that as well. So it's kind of an interesting thing where it's not purely mechanical, because you know someone has to decide to trust it enough to hold the Bitcoin and not rotate out. But what is it that they can trust is the hard mathematics that go into it.
Yes. So it's the interesting part, yeah. isn't it, where you put trust into a trustless mechanism.
Yeah.
And because it's trustless, so there's no middleman, then basically you can you put your faith in it.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well to see how those perspectives have changed over time, because certainly in the early days, you know, there was maybe excitement around the idea you could have an arena of these competing coins. And this is even from an Austrian economics perspective, something that Hayek talks about always is you know, a free market for private currencies and a competitive market as opposed to the fiat of a nation state currency. And so you can see, I mean, Bitcoin is the lion's share of the crypto market, stable coins aside. And so it's quite interesting how that kind of trust and trustlessness kind of play off each other. How did your finance background sort of feed into your understanding of how Bitcoin works?
So I think, as with anybody who works in finance, initially you have to be extremely skeptical about cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin in general, blockchains in general, because there's no recourse for any sort of malfunction or, you know, wrong actions. So you have to be very, very skeptical. But I think as we become more and more exposed to it, we're realizing that, okay, there may be, like, you know, this sort of consequences is something that is actually tolerable for, in some cases, maybe very specific. Probably it depends on the person. And in those cases, then it just becomes a part of the systemic risk that you accept in exchange for participating in this environment.
Well, and what are the alternatives as well? Like the world's sort of changed quite a lot, where we are seeing people move out on the risk curve, and we'll get into this in a moment with Counter-Strike skins and these loot boxes and things. But I mean, where else are you going to park your value, right?
Yes, I think that's a very, very good point, Cody. Because basically, right, especially in probably less so in the last couple of years, but especially during the 2010s, where there was extremely low interest rates, you always have to find something with high yield to park your money in.
I find it quite interesting, the perspective that you bring, I guess looking at markets, looking at fintech, looking at that legacy TradFi world. The lens you bring to Bitcoin is quite illuminating, because it doesn't maybe sit in that tribal space, right? You know, you've done the work to look at Bitcoin and to sort of clearly, you know, identify as the premier cryptocurrency. But how do you think we can have these conversations about something like Bitcoin that's quite new, that maybe is quite triggering for a lot of people who are either firmly skeptical or some people also firmly in support of, without sort of maybe looking in a clear way at the broader landscape?
I think actually you just let time do its work. I think as we see more institutional uptaking of cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin in general, like we have ETFs for Bitcoin and Ethereum now, then basically the two worlds have already started overlapping in a quite a significant way. So I think people who are sort of like me, who take a more centrist type of approach to these sort of new classes of asset, I think we'll eventually like manage to converge somewhere in the middle. That's my belief.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a bit of a shakeout, right? Like, yeah, over time. And I think it's quite interesting now, because, you know, we are seeing, I mean, I've taken a bit of a step back from, I guess what you could say, Bitcoin Twitter. I mean, it's sort of, it's not really like the old days, if it ever was. You know, what are the old days? But there's still an underlying technology that keeps going. You know, we say TikTok, next block, you know, the miners are still doing their thing. The nodes are out there doing their thing. People are using this. You can see the usage on the Block Explorer, and it's just working, you know, without any of the noise. And I think this is, I don't know how closely you've been following a lot of these discussions, but it's a bit tiring, to be honest, like, so the ongoing discourse. You know, people are, It's like they've got nowhere else to direct their energy.
Mm.
And so it's like, look, what are you going to do, right?
Yeah.
And so taking a step back from that, the fact that it still works as intended.
The thing we can definitely say right now is that the system hasn't broken yet.
Yeah.
So I think, I personally do not consider myself to be a Bitcoin or crypto maximalist. I consider crypto to be a class of asset, just like any other class of asset. Because, having gone through, entered after Mt. Gox, and then gone through the ICO boom and bust, and then the 2020s boom and bust, and now I think we're going through another boom and bust cycle right now. I'd say that, with every single one of these cycles, I think it just becomes more mature as a class.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's interesting as well, that I think of myself, in a sense, as a Bitcoin maximalist, also a monetary maximalist. I think using it as money is the use case it was designed for.
Mm.
And what I find refreshing about your perspective is that it's perhaps maybe the general consensus outside of a much narrower group of Bitcoin enthusiasts who are looking at it from this monetary lens. I think the vast majority of people do see it in that asset space, and it's not that that's wrong, it's more that, we have to accept that is how they're seeing it. That's reality, right?
Mm.
And then how do you work with that? Is there innovations or technology missing, or there are things that need to be developed to bring that monetary use case to the front? Is it an education thing? But I think sitting in a place where So you're claiming someone's kind of incorrect in their stance when clearly it's what most people are using it for. Mm. I don't know if you get answers from that. You know what I mean?
No, absolutely. I agree with you. I mean, like I described, right? I think the more centrist approach is probably the most, I would say, the most healthy way for this to be to undertake anyway. Because I feel like everyone has sort of with almost any asset class, everyone gets too passionate. You have the people who, will not sell any of their stock no matter what the price is.
Mm.
And then you have the people who will dump at every single, dip. So people are driven by emotions. And I think Bitcoin and crypto is no different. And sometimes we overreact. And I think we're humans, so that's normal.
Mm.
And but I think as part of Bitcoin being institutionalized, then basically it also becomes financialized, then inevitably then it will gain those kind of attributes that's also to do with other asset classes.
Yeah, I think what's also perhaps the most powerful piece of it is that even if it is institutionalized, it can still be used in a way that is self-sovereign. And I think that's where I come back to, is that ultimately most people are not interested in using it as money. They don't have the interest, or they don't even have the facilities. It is hard in some places to spend your Bitcoin with people, and so the fact though is that that option is available, and fundamentally that's not gate kept, I think, is really important. But as a store of value, as an asset, I think that's you've got to have an asset before it can be monetized in at least in the Austrian tradition. What is the value that's underwriting this money? Mm. So I think this is interesting, and it is a middle way to look at it, and I don't think it's actually a negative to the Bitcoin project, like the idea that the money, that the store of value continues to just grow over time. That's not a bad place to be.
Mm.
The other place you could be is you've got this thing you think is an asset that is actually collapsing, and we do see that with a lot of these other cryptos, as over time they're sort of starting to die off and bleed out. And the one that Bitcoin has its ups and downs, but fundamentally there's enough demand there that there is a value sustained in that asset, right?
Yeah, I think like you said, right? Definitely, Bitcoin benefits from, I believe, from being the first mover, and it maintains a high degree of trust compared to most other cryptocurrencies.
Mm.
And in the short term, especially actually even in the midterm and long term, as it's becoming more institutionalized, as more institutions take up on it, then it becomes more and more embedded into the traditional financial system anyway. Then in that case, then basically that trust will not be going away, but it'll just take a different form. So in my vision, I see it as like basically the institutionalized Bitcoin is one product and the self-sovereign Bitcoin as another product. Kind of similar to like decentralized exchanges and centralized exchanges. Like not the best sort of analogy, but you get what I mean.
Yeah. Well, fundamentally there is a connection underneath, right? And yeah. You know, an individual's risk tolerance, right? If they want to go self-sovereign, the risk is on them. And if they want to use an exchange or an ETF, the risk is on the provider. And there's trade-offs and benefits,
because right? If we think about the original Bitcoin paper, so that was a very, very crypto-punk approach of...
Cypherpunk, yeah.
Yeah, cypherpunk, my apologies. Yeah. Not the NFT.
Yeah.
Very, very cypherpunk approach of where basically you bank yourself. That was the vision, and Bitcoin as a currency that you can spend. That vision, I think, we have deviated from that quite a bit, because the current narrative of Bitcoin being a storage of value is what allows it to be financialized in this current situation. And because of that, hence my view of it being self-sovereign Bitcoin as one product and sort of centralized exchange Bitcoin or institutionally trade Bitcoin as another product. But I see different purposes for these two products. They're targeting different people, different audiences, and they can coexist, in my opinion.
Well, what I find interesting as well, and you and I are both members of the Foreign Correspondents Club of Japan, and we often are going and there's deep dive talks about finance, about monetary policy. I mean, obviously Japan is a key player in the global economy. There's a lot of talk lately about the carry trade. A lot of things pass through Tokyo, and because we're here on the ground, we can actually kind of get access to that. And what I find interesting is that for the vast majority of people that we encountered there, they're not even really aware of that self-sovereign aspect of Bitcoin. And I find that always very illuminating, that there's, you know, that they, you know, I talk to these people, they've never even made a Bitcoin transaction. You know, they see it purely in this kind of asset, it's something they maybe read about, it's something they maybe have in an ETF, but to actually go and run a node to use Bitcoin as intended, it's like they didn't even know about it, right? Which I find kind of a little bit of a shame, but you know, we're doing our bit to educate them. But it's like, once you are out in that world of finance and, you know, international banking and stuff, you know, that's how they see it. And this sort of self-sovereign cypherpunk use case is almost forgotten about, right?
Well, because I think for most people, right, especially people who sort of joined the craze, especially around, say, 2020, because that was kind of, I feel, when Bitcoin really started to break into mainstream because of all the talks about ETFs, etc. So I feel like, you know, when you have a hammer, every problem is a nail, right? That's the way you see it. So I think for most people, you know, I'm quite sure most of them would not have read the original paper, and they probably wouldn't even have any exposure to any kind of software that runs Bitcoin underneath, right? For most of them, maybe their first impression is from like Bloomberg, from FT, Wall Street Journal. And then if they dig slightly deeper, it might be Coinbase, that kind of like those kind of exchanges, Gemini, Kraken. So I think to them, if you see it through this lens, then of course you just treat it as an asset class.
Well, it's kind of like, I think of it like the theory of mind, which is how do you put yourself into someone else's shoes and how do you see through their eyes? And again, these people that we know in that world, they're looking at this in terms of what's written in Bloomberg or what's the latest article about Bitcoin, as opposed to what is Bitcoin. And I think there's like a epistemological difference there, a difference of understanding, of knowledge. When I'm talking about my node around self-custody, around you know, some of the underlying mechanics of it, it almost, you know, their eyes glaze over, that, you know, they've never had to really think about that. And this is obviously the great question that gets people, is what is money? And I mean, that's a rabbit hole of its own, but it's like, they're looking at it, I think, through a systems lens of, okay, how does this fit into the current system?
Yes.
And even, I think, the idea of, like, the current system, it's sort of, there's not really a way to get out of the current system. I mean, the system is the system. And, I mean, if anything, Bitcoin has extended the range of possibilities within the system.
Mm-hmm.
But fundamentally, you know, we're all playing in the arena of the economy.
Yeah.
And Bitcoin is just another part of the economy. And so we can refigure other parts of the economy around Bitcoin, but fundamentally the whole project, you know, how does it flow into that? And where is the, you know, where are the flows of money? And I think maybe if you're sort of in your bunker, right, you know, you've got your Bitcoin, how do you put that into the context of goods and services? How do you put that into the context of the economy? Maybe that's not something that a lot of people get to, right? Because they're just sitting on it, right?
I think the problem is, like, right, with the initial paper,
yeah,
Bitcoin is designed to be a payment system. It's designed to be to serve the role of a currency. And purely because of transaction fees being so expensive, that has sort of, like, pushed that out of the equation until Lightning Network came, right? But when Lightning Network came, then all of a sudden, like, Bitcoin's no longer the single player in cryptocurrencies industry, so to speak. You have other coins that can process just as cheaply, if not even more cheap, than Bitcoin. Then I think in that case, that's lost ground for Bitcoin to serve in that role. So hence, the natural pivot would be, because of its high price comparatively, to serve as a store of value. Which in this case is kind of awkward in that sense, isn't it? That, like, it's designed to be a currency, but it can't serve as a currency, so it needs to serve as store of value right now and become an asset class. So I feel like it's caught in the middle at the moment.
Yeah, it's an interesting space. I mean, this is where I think, from a Bitcoin perspective, you would come back to the principles, right? And this kind of, there's almost this comfort in the theory.
Mm.
And I mean, it's theory, but brackets, it's also practice, because you can obviously run a node and do mining and do these things that contribute to the theoretical reason why Bitcoin is superior. But yeah, in the messy reality of the market, where things are, you know, people are putting their money into Counter-Strike skins, and they're putting their money into, you know, NFTs and all sorts of things. You know, there is like an irrationality to the market, which can outlast your own belief in the theory and the underpinnings of something like Bitcoin, right? So it's sort of, I often find myself, you know, I'm interested in the theory, and we come back to these kind of pristine ideas, this pristine money, 21 million, these kinds of things, right? But then we're seeing that get assaulted by naturally becoming financialized. We know there's paper Bitcoin out there, that there's, you know, derivatives and all sorts of things. You know, there's more than 21 million Bitcoin trading on these exchanges and in these ETFs. You know, you call it paper Bitcoin. And I have read some dissenting claims around, well, that is a failure of Bitcoin, and so the project is lost, because, you know, they can just print, you know, paper Bitcoin and issue it on these exchanges, and who's ever going to really withdraw it to their own wallet? So it's sort of, I don't think it's a lost cause in that sense whatsoever, but, I mean, maybe there is a grain of truth there that, you know, once it is captured, they can sort of snip it off and start sort of just circulating these paper IOUs on top. Does that mean the project's failed, or does it mean that it's working in different ways? I don't know.
I'd say the latter, because I feel like it's kind of like a, like, think of like a famous rock band coming up with a song, and then the song, like, probably it's got some gibberish lyrics, but then, like, the audience loves the song and basically gives it a new meaning. I think that kind of analogy works for Bitcoin right now.
It is what it is, yeah.
Yes, basically, like, Satoshi came up with this idea. He branded it as an experiment initially as well, right? And, you know, the idea is that this is a currency, but it has turned into something else. I don't think there's a right or wrong. It's just what happened.
Well, yeah, it's emergent, right? Yeah. Like, what has it become? And I think this is interesting, because, as you say, I mean, there was a high coming off the 2020 period, and now we're, you know, we're into this new space where, very, you know, recently there was some all-time high values on Bitcoin, but it's been a pullback. There's been maybe some own sort of inter-tribal troubles with Bitcoin on a cultural level, you know, quotes. But what this fundamental, fundamentally, I mean, for me, I come back to the kind of the underpinnings and the theory of it, and it gives me confidence. And I mean, we've talked about this as well. I mean, you said to me the other day, you know, now's a great time to be DCAing into Bitcoin. You know, not finance,
does not constitute as financial advice,
but look, I think, you know, clearly, and this is the interesting piece though, because this is when we get back into the encounter with the market, because I sent you an article on the carry trade and how, you know, who really wanted to be selling their Bitcoin. You know, was it the carry trade that squeezed some people who needed to reallocate?
I mean, people who get margin called, right?
You know, and so this is where now we're at the point where, you know, this thing isn't playing in its own sandbox. You know, this is in the real economy as a asset that is playing a pivotal role.
I think, like you said, right, I think actually that's one sign of Bitcoin becoming mature, isn't it? Because basically now people are actually putting in serious money. So that, like, say, for example, if they're getting margin called, they have to sell some Bitcoins to come and fill up their coffers. That is something that you could not have imagined.
That wouldn't happen before.
2015,
yeah.
When I got in. Or 2018, before ICO, the whole ICO craze.
Yeah.
Like, there's just not enough real money in there back then for this to happen. But now we see it. People liquidate it as they have to fill it, right? Just like any other asset class.
Yeah, so I think in that sense that, looking at the recent moves with silver, with Bitcoin, it's clear to me that there was a reallocation, there was a movement around there, perhaps because people were being margin called. And again, that's directly because of what's happening with the yen and the Bank of Japan. And that's interesting, because that's now, again, confronting and encountering the real economy. And this maybe sits in contrast to what we're going to talk about in a moment, which is this wild west of Counter-Strike skins and these things that are way out on the edge, which still, in a sense, they sort of have slipped through the cracks. They don't really have that kind of same surface area, right? So I do want to begin to talk about that. And coming back to Counter-Strike, I was having this conversation, we're having a coffee the other day, and you're telling me about, you just sold a Counter-Strike skin, I think.
Yes.
It's
for around 60 USD.
60 US dollars, yep.
Yes.
But you had been, we went for a walk, I think, before that, and you were telling me about how you had begun purchasing these skins, right? Mm. And it was really interesting, because as someone who played Counter-Strike as a kid, back in the day, was it Counter-Strike 1.6, Counter-Strike Source. So what is Counter-Strike? So it's a shooting game. We were talking about 5v5. I think you can have competitive matches with your five people.
5v5, competitive, 10v10, casual games.
Online games, computer game. Yes. It's been, I think, came out in 1999 as a Half-Life mod, officially, I think, picked up by Valve a little bit later.
Yes, made by two college kids, I think.
So it was a modification to Half-Life. Yes. And so it got this video game, right? And again, this is interesting, because it's kind of prefiguring, got these two teams, right? The terrorists and the counter-terrorists, which kind of is prefiguring kind of 2001, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's pretty interesting that, as of today, though, with the current version of Counter-Strike CS2, which launched in 2023, it has 20 million plus active players, which is pretty incredible. And one of the things, getting into this question of value, though, within the game, you get these loot boxes, and you can buy a key. It's $2.50 to unlock the loot boxes, and then you can have the chance to find a rare skin. So a skin is decoration, kind of a custom design on the gun, right?
Yes.
Your uniform as well, I guess.
So basically, there are three main types of skins. There's the one for your weapon. So in this case, will be a gun or a knife. There can be gloves. So gloves just on your agent, and then there can be the agent skin itself.
Yeah.
So there are three main types of skins. When weapons is the one by far most popular.
Yeah. So we've got this kind of interesting marketplace that emerged. And it was really interesting, because the design of this economy is actually, as far as I was looking into this, Valve actually hired a guy, Yanis Varoufakis, who would later become Greece's finance minister.
Yes. And I believe he talks on BBC right now as well, quite often.
Which is interesting. So we've got this kind of, this interesting emergence of a virtual economy through these video games, which is, it's kind of, I mean, the kind of apocryphal story of Ethereum is that it came out of World of Warcraft, and the idea that, oh, well, why shouldn't I not be able to hold on to my my items in game? You know, why is it that the company is the one managing that for me? Why can't I have a smart contract that does it?
Hence NFTs.
So it was interesting because there's this kind of connection with games. But getting into the economy, you blew my mind when you told me that the economy peaked at $6 billion just at the end of last year.
With a B.
With a B. $6 billion US. So, man, how do you frame this? Like, give me the high level. How do you frame this market?
I mean, what can I say? I think my own view is you've got like a combination of irrationality due to people with a passion of owning scarcity, showing off, and probably, if I may say, a little bit of capital flight as well.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. So the biggest market, Buff163, I don't fully know what that means.
So quick introduction. Yeah. Once 163.com is a domain owned by NetEase in China, which is one of the biggest game companies now in the world even. So they've developed some recent games like Delta Force, and Marvel Rifles. So they're actually working with a lot of Western IPs now as well. And they run this marketplace called Buff, which is Buff163.com. This place is basically a third-party website where people can trade skins, Counter-Strike skins and Dota skins. And and it's mainly targeted towards Chinese mainland citizens.
Yeah.
So it's basically a domestic market.
That's interesting. So we've got a substantial share of this growth is, as you say, coming from China. And I mean, maybe we can talk a little bit about that, because I mean, people may be aware that there's capital control issues in China. You know, it can be hard to get money out. But maybe you could frame how does that capital flight, capital control aspect fit into the way, maybe the flow of Chinese money, and in particular these Counter-Strike markets?
So I think first of all is basically we have a interesting phenomenon which happened until recently, was there was an overseas premium for trading these skins. So we'll pay more for these skins outside of China than inside China. So I'm not sure what's the cause of that, but what happened was then basically it spawned this population of traders who reside in China or have access to Chinese financial system, banking accounts, to use this to arbitrage. So then they started buying skins from Chinese marketplace such as Buff and start selling them at overseas marketplace. So how they can do that is because basically, there are two types of marketplaces. One is called the bot marketplace, which is basically there's an automated bot which can be the middleman. And basically, you send the skin to the bot as escrow. And then the bot also takes money from the buyer as escrow and then gives you both parties whatever you need. So after the trade. Or there is a second one, which is called a peer-to-peer marketplace. So how that works is, in that case, the marketplace only takes the money as escrow, but the actual sending of the skin happens between the two parties, the buyer and the seller. So the seller will send the skin through the Steam community system, and then once that has been verified, the marketplace will pay the escrow money back to the seller. The buyer will have to deposit into the marketplace first.
Because Buff
is the one, I would say.
Yeah, because Buff is the biggest market, right? And that's peer-to-peer, isn't it?
Yes.
So they're I'm not sure if I got the ratio, but they're definitely the largest third-party skin marketplace. So that's peer-to-peer. And then what are some of the automated marketplaces?
So say, for example, the bot marketplaces, there are some called like Waxpeer, Bitskins, Skinport, D-Market.
And what's the difference there? Like, is it a trust issue, do you think? Or why would you go with the automated marketplaces versus the peer-to-peer?
So the bot marketplaces, it's basically an artifact of history.
Yeah.
So they came in first.
Oh, I see.
So it's because there was the trust issue that any trade, right? So it brings us back to the whole trustless system thing, right? So back then there was no trustless system. So the bot marketplaces came in first, but then people figured out how to do it in a peer-to-peer manner.
Yeah.
So then peer-to-peer became the mainstream afterwards.
So what's interesting, and I think we're beginning to paint a picture here, that this company Valve, which is a private company, so it's not publicly traded, which is maybe rare in the game industry. I'm not sure.
Very rare, yeah. I would say, especially for a company of that size.
And it's also with so Valve that
in terms of market cap, that is.
Yes. So Valve, the company, they made the original Half-Life that Counter-Strike came from. But importantly, in the early 2000s, they came out with Steam, which you mentioned. So Steam is this, what do you call it? It's the game
delivery platform service.
Yeah.
Yes.
So back in the old days, you would buy the CD, you would install the game, you would have it on your machine, and you could give it to a friend if you wanted to. Steam started doing more sort of their DRM, digital rights management stuff, right? Yes. And then eventually you got rid of the CDs, you started just downloading the games directly through your Steam account. So this has been in effect, you know, around for 20 plus years now at this point. And so we've got this marketplace, this delivery mechanism. Valve, though, is ultimately the one at the bottom of all of this, settling those transactions. And so it's really interesting to me, man, that we're like basically recreating, you know, sort of banking systems and these kind of settlement systems.
Yes.
In the way out on the curve with this video game delivery platform.
I guess it's kind of like a mirror of the financial system as well, isn't it? So initially you have bartering, which is the whole Steam item sending, receiving, and then you have the financialization and economization of these marketplaces. So Steam has its own official marketplace, and then people figured out how to do third-party marketplaces by automating.
You say barter, and I mean, the history of money is long and complex, but I mean, there are certainly people who don't think barter was ever part of it. What actually, though, is interesting, though, because again, this came out, this ability to have, like when I was playing Counter-Strike, skins weren't a thing. There was no economy in the game.
Mm.
And then there was this arms deal update that happened around 2014, I think. Yes. And that 2013, the arms deal update, that's when everything changed. And that was, in effect, Valve monetizing, inflating the economy of the game, of the in-game economy, because that now enabled these loot boxes and these fiat items, right? Because effectively they are, you can use them in the game, but they're not a real commodity. They're
virtual. There's no intrinsic value.
Yeah. They got monetized in the game. Artificial scarcity was introduced because, I mean, there is effectively unlimited amounts of these things that could be done.
And yes.
Could be printed into the game. And so in effect, you know, it was actually the central bank, aka the government of Valve, which has its own, I guess, fiefdom, right? Because if Valve doesn't like you, they'll just kick you out of their thing. They'll ban you, right?
Indeed.
So there's almost, I'm starting to see sort of quasi-government kind of, you know, aspects here where, you know,
I think fiefdom is the right word that you mentioned.
So, I mean, how do we break this down? Because I think, again, we were talking about Bitcoin before, we're talking about, you know, the fintech world. It's a lot closer to our reality, right? But in this virtual space, which is quite clearly delineated, we know where it finishes and where it starts when it comes to Counter-Strike. You know, you can just turn the computer off, right? You know, you don't have to play the game. It actually maybe provides a really good way of understanding money and the power dynamics in money and this idea of trust, right? So yeah, how do we even begin to break this down? So we had this ARM deal update that happened, and that's, I mean, were you playing Counter-Strike then? Like, what do you remember from that period?
No. So I got into Counter-Strike Global Offensive around 2020 because of the pandemic.
Okay.
So yeah, before then I basically had a whole decade of not playing games.
Okay.
So
you came into the market as it was already.
Yes, I came as a freshman at 2020, not even knowing that these pixels are worth anything at all.
Yeah.
So I've done my fair share of selling skins, which is apparently worth quite a lot, but for peanuts.
So you interesting. So you went through your period of your 10,000 Bitcoin for a pizza period.
Not quite that magnitude, but yes.
Interesting. But this idea, though, that, you know, Valve has effectively come up with this mechanism of building its own economy within the game. I think this is profound because we can apply this to other games as well.
Mm.
But the way they do it as well, this idea that there's a $2.50 key that you have to buy in the game, or someone has to buy to have the chance to unlock a high-value skin in one of these loot boxes. I mean, how do you frame that mechanism? I mean, this is, it's not a proof-of-work mechanism. I mean, what is that monetary system? I mean, how would we begin to describe that?
I think it's actually not dissimilar to a proof-of-stake.
Yeah.
If you think about it, right? So you put $2.50 in, that's your stake, right? So for some, like, maybe it depends on who you are, but for some people, like, you can attach monetary value with the $2.50 onto that skin. Or let's say, for example, if you open a very rare skin, there's sentimental value there for you, perhaps.
It's interesting as well, because I think in some parts of Europe, the loot boxes are classified as gambling.
I believe France, it's banned to do loot boxes.
Yeah, Belgium and Netherlands as well have
classified
paid loot boxes as illegal. And then France requires the X-ray scanner.
Exactly. That is a workaround.
So the X-ray scanner, you can see what's inside the case before you buy.
Yes.
But you must purchase that item before scanning the next one. So you kind of have a chance to... Yay or nay?
Yes. But still you have to pay if you want to buy the next one.
Anyway. And so Valve argues that it's not gambling.
Yes. Because you know what you're getting. That's what they're arguing.
So it's interesting. So we now have these kind of regional differences where a few, I guess, are like region locked in some parts of Europe, you're not able to participate in the economy in the same way.
Yes. So actually, here is where they came up with the newest mechanism, which is called the Armory. So what happens there is they sell it as a battle pass, where basically you pay a fixed amount. I can't remember how much it was, around $15-$20. Then basically you buy this battle pass. By having this battle pass, you can earn stars. And then with stars, you can then buy a chance of getting a skin. So this is another way.
It's quite convoluted. Yeah.
Yes, convoluted, but I think it's easily understood by people who play games. But it's a quite an ingenious way of basically sidestepping the loot box problem that Europe is trying to ban.
It's interesting though, because again, I see so many like comparisons with what we're talking about in the Bitcoin space or within the fintech world that, you know, there is an arena here where people are playing these games, but then there's this financial aspect that is, again, very much beginning to resemble the structures. I mean, we got Mika and the like financial frameworks in EU, and now and the same kind of regulations are coming downstream for these games, right? And I don't know, how do you frame it? Because I mean, it seems like they're the same kind of thing in a way. They're like, you know, there's value in these things for people, a subjective value.
I think my personal opinion is basically it's an unregulated security.
Okay.
Not dissimilar to the NFTs of 2020.
Yeah.
That's the way I see it. Because, the only difference is you have one centralized entity in Valve Corporation who can, you know, maintain the fairness of the system, right? So that's where people put their trust in, because these are ultimately just pixels, just like CryptoPunks.
What's interesting as well is, unlike a decentralized system, because there is a single issuer who have a financial incentive to not rug pull their entire customer base, we are seeing, because there was an update a couple of months ago, right, that caused some issues. Do you know what was the cause of that?
So, long story short, there are different tiers of skins. So the lowest tier is like gray, and then gradually goes up to like light blue, dark blue, purple, pink, red, and at the very top is gold. And this gold tier of skins is usually the rarest. And what they usually are like knife skins or glove skins. So that basically the pixels that you will see all the time.
When you're holding the knife. Yeah.
Yes, in the game.
Yeah.
So that's why they're gold tier, right? Yeah. So the newest update that they introduced in October 2025 allows you to trade 5 red skins into 1 gold skin. So this trade up system has always been there, but you could trade all the way from like gray up to red, but never from red to gold. There was a barrier. They broke that barrier, and basically you can trade 5 reds into 1 gold. And I believe that is kind of signifying a little bit of the destruction of trust there. Because in the sense that, okay, people have gotten so used to not being able to trade up into gold skins for like almost a decade that they just assume that this will be perpetual. But for that change, it totally broke that trust. Hence, a lot of the gold skin prices, especially the ones that don't look very good cosmetically, they just got dumped.
Yeah, it was a major... the whole market went down.
And as a result, the whole market went down because the trust left the system. Temporarily, perhaps, but it left the system. And right now, it's just slowly recovering.
Well, you know, what's very interesting is historically, different countries have experimented with fixed ratios between silver and gold.
Mm.
And I think historically in England, it was like 15 to 1. Mm. And there's been times in the past where they've like changed the ratio. Yeah. We've got the question of convertibility.
The real life trade up.
Yeah. Well, you know, 1971 convertibility. And what you're saying is it's this exact same thing. It's like when the rules are changed, trust leaves. And if you measure trust as a kind of a public good, or you know, if you were to quantify trust somehow, necessarily changing the rules affects the net trust in the system.
Because I mean, like, right, even just as a businessman myself, right, having a predictable environment is extremely important for running a business. And once money is involved, it's business for everybody, isn't it?
Yeah, that's fascinating. So we got this. They had these kind of structural changes. And I mean, do you think this was something that Valve understood, that they were going to mess with the system?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think so.
Why do you think they went ahead, though, and still did the change?
Because I think ultimately, for the good of the game in their eyes, they don't want precious skins in terms of like money value or sentimental value to be hogged by a select group of people. Because that is basically what was happening before this change. Because of the scarcity of some very precious skins being bought up by rich people.
So effectively, we're saying, again, the analogy to the fiefdom or the government, we're seeing it's like a tax the rich kind of a movement within the Counter-Strike.
Yeah, I guess you can say that.
Because, I mean, give me an idea. I mean, what are we talking about with some of these high-value skins? I mean, what are some of the high-priced
items? So let's say, for example, right, like the one of the most wanted skins is called an AWP Dragon Lore. So it's basically just a sniper rifle, like yellow, gold, with like a dragon painted on it. And this skin, like even the lowest, I think right now is around $5,000. And the most expensive one, like, would be like a souvenir factory new Dragon Lore, would easily cost up to almost like $600,000 to $1 million.
That's incredible.
Yes, and I mean, it's proven as well that people are willing to pay that kind of money, because there's a very, another example would be, there are these things called blue gems in this game, where basically it's a very rare pattern where the whole knife or whole gun is blue for a certain skin. And there have been proven records of people paying $1 million to $1.5 million for these kind of skins.
Yeah, I mean, this brings it back to the China piece as well, because obviously Chinese New Year, dragons,
yes,
there's kind of symbols, right? And so there's this sort of perhaps insight on the Valve side, at least, that things like this have enough aesthetic value, collective value, to appeal to the Chinese market, who... maybe we'll dive into this, who are trying to find something to put their value in so they can pull it out on the other side and move money around. So let's talk a little bit about that, the cash flow and that capital flow through these systems. So there's a premium between China and overseas. How does that work in practice? How are Chinese people using this to get money out of China?
So I think for the people who are versed in this world, basically for them, opening an account overseas is very easy, because most of these marketplaces are online. So for a lot of them, basically opening the one on Buff is the hard part, right? But they reside in China. They already can do that. So then they only have to open another one elsewhere, have access to an overseas banking account, which may or may not be easy. I guess that's the only part, right? Or
I'll have a friend.
Yes. Or bringing us back to our area, you can withdraw crypto.
Oh, really?
Yes. So in a lot of these marketplaces, you can deposit and withdraw crypto. By doing some minimal KYC, you can already do that. So that's how they can facilitate. That's how they can trade profit. Or even if they don't even care about the profit, they basically just liquidate through these platforms.
Yeah, and interesting that, I guess, over time, the APIs and the integrations with these with settling on Steam have meant that, I guess, you can just go ahead and build these marketplaces. I mean, I don't know, what does it take to get access to that Steam API for building marketplaces?
I think it's free.
Okay.
Yeah, I think anyone can build
tools related to that. So we've got this interesting place where, again, comparing it with the financial system, which is totally gatekept and regulated, we have, in a sense, a sort of a sandbox here where there's documentation, there is a way to engage with this API. A final settlement happens with Valve, but you can go ahead and build marketplaces and visualizers and escrows and all sorts of things kind of at the edges increasingly. And then that enables liquidity to come into the system. You can then do swaps into cryptocurrencies and other things. Mm-hmm. So there's all these other things starting to emerge, but it's fundamentally, it's kind of the core piece is that Valve central bank at the core of it all, right?
I guess you can think of it as a third-party country called Valve that you can funnel your funds through.
Yeah, that's interesting. So in this question then, I mean, is this something, do you think, I mean, where's the regulation sit with this, and how do you think it's seen from the regulatory perspective?
I think it's, for regulation, I think the hard part is basically because these are not securities. So it's very hard for, say, somebody like SEC to come in, right? Because they're pixels. Because I think Valve can always argue that these are pixels. They're not supposed to worth anything. If people want to fix a price tag on them, I can't stop them. Which I think is true. I mean,
maybe this is how people see the world that I'm in with Bitcoin, and they're like, man, how do you, you know, it's just data. How do you, you know?
It's just ones and zeros. Why is it worth 120K?
That's rat poison, right? And exactly. It's interesting.
You can't prevent somebody from fixing a price onto a bunch of pixels or a bunch of zeros and ones. So I think in that case, unless there's a reclassification of these kind of things as securities, then that I see as already the first, you know, problem of regulating it. And the second part is, this will be cross-jurisdiction, wouldn't it? I'm not too sure.
Well, Valve is operating everywhere, right? So
yeah, but I guess they'd incorporated in the state. So I guess ultimately, I think they possess ownership. I think I read something very recently. Basically, these skins is owned by Valve, and they license it for you to use. So ultimate ownership resides in Valve. So I guess, wouldn't that mean that legally, they are just, you know, my left hand passing a skin to my right hand?
Yeah.
But my left hand is licensing the skin for you to use, and right hand's licensing the skin for me to use.
Yeah. Well, I mean, where do you see the future of these markets? I mean, is it going to continue to grow, do you think, or?
I think that's the same question as cryptocurrencies, because especially non-yield earning cryptocurrencies, right? How much trust is left in the market, in the system, right? So at the moment, we're seeing that the market cap is starting to come back up. So it went from, I believe, 6 billion down to 4 billion, and now it's back to around 5 billion. So obviously, trust has not left the market, despite that change that we mentioned last October. Then, I mean, it's really hard to predict, isn't it? Like, ultimately, the player base will probably still determine. It's kind of like the participants in cryptocurrency networks. The player base will determine how much these skins are worth, because you still got the side where I have a Dragon Lore and I want to show it off to you. I want you to say wow when I use that Dragon Lore. There's still that side. I think that side is also relevant.
Well, it's kind of like conspicuous consumption, like having the Louis Vuitton bag.
Yes.
Or something.
It's luxury, right?
Luxury, yeah.
It's a civil status.
Because I think that it's interesting, because that would be maybe a point of difference with Bitcoin, where, you know, the whale is anonymous and would like to probably stay anonymous.
Well, I would say that if you do say that, hey, I have paper key for have a paper wallet for, I don't know, 250 Bitcoin, then I think immediately people will be like, yeah, let's get the guy into a dark alley, right?
Yeah. So it's interesting that, you know, you've got this conspicuous consumption of these, you know, sniper rifle skins and these gloves and things. And, you know, some of them worth quite substantial money, as you say. But, you know, this is in this area where there's a market cap of, you know, $5-6 billion, where it's still, I didn't know about this, really. I knew it was a thing, but I didn't realize how much it was.
I still remember the day that Bitcoin broke 1 billion market cap and we were rejoicing.
Yeah.
That was many years ago.
Yeah. But it's like, you know, maybe as things scale, you know, there's just a satiation of, you know, how many Counter-Strike players are there in the world? 20 million, you know, is that the limit of this, that there's not much growth until you maybe start getting derivative markets? You know, I don't know. Is there such a thing as someone who just trades their skins and doesn't play the game?
I think so.
Oh, yeah?
I mean, I'm speculating purely, right? But I would say, like, as of any kind of securities, in quotes, if there's money to be made, right, there's people willing to make money.
Because I wonder whether that's sort of...
market force at work.
Yeah, again, 20 million players, you know, that's...
I mean, let's say, for example, right, basically on this topic, there's a bot problem in Counter-Strike right now, where there are some games that's played by 20 bots, and all that they're doing is they're trying to farm these cases. So they're not even trying to open the cases, they're just trying to farm the cases. So basically, getting as many of these cases as possible, because...
Do they pop up randomly? Or?
So basically what happens is you're guaranteed one case per week. So then there are people buying accounts to farm these cases and then just sell those cases off, even without opening them.
Can you just collect the case without opening it?
Yes. So the case itself is worth money, especially rare cases. So recently Valve saw that problem, because what they were doing until last month was they were dropping rare cases with a very, very low chance, like around 1% chance of that dropping for your weekly drop. So basically you get four choices, you choose two out of the four, and one of them is possible to get a rare drop. And the problem is some of those old cases are so expensive, they're hitting like $80 to $100. So hence there are bot farms, not dissimilar to the old World of Warcraft gold farms, to just make money.
So that's kind of maybe the proof of work space, right? Where there's these bots running, you know, consuming resources, you know, computer resources.
Yeah. It's proof of something.
Proof of something. Interesting. Proof of case. Interesting. And I think the other piece, I don't know if you ever had this in Australia or Hong Kong, but in New Zealand we had this thing called bonus bonds, where they don't run them anymore, but you could sort of... It's kind of like a lottery system, and it was run through, I think, through ANZ Bank. And you buy like a bonus bond, and you have the chance to win the bond payout. It might have been monthly. And the more kind of bonds you brought, the more of a chance you had of winning. And it sort of the mathematics worked out.
Sounds like a raffle.
Yeah. It's like kind of like raffles type system.
Yeah.
I'm getting those sort of vibes here, where, you know, you have a chance to win with these cases. You got to pay to, you know, on that kind of lowest level where these new units come into the economy, you have to be paying though. So it's sort of, in a sense, it's sort of like a raffle system, a bonus bond system. And then there's there's some sort of decoration around these different types of cases. So there's like, they've added some nuance there, but fundamentally you've got to pay to play.
Yes.
And so there's sort of a, I don't know, there's a participation cost there.
It's a slot machine.
And I mean, that's been running though for, you know, 10 years plus.
Mm.
You know, the tokenomics of it work out.
I mean, unofficially, there are research that's done by the Twitter community that Valve rakes in around $2 billion as revenue from cases.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Per year?
Yeah, okay. Per year. So that is not a small amount to be raking in from cases.
Well, it's interesting because that's the... Well,
just from buying keys.
Yeah.
Buying keys and then taking a cut if they do... there are trades in the Steam community market.
Yeah, it's like a 2.5% fee, right? I think.
More than that, it's like 12% fee.
Okay.
12-15% fee.
Okay.
But basically, they can rake in $2 billion.
Yeah. I don't know if it, I don't see it happening in the US, but do you think regulation would come in and wipe this market out, or do you think it's priced into the value of the marketplace that, you know, people are confident it will keep existing?
I'm not sure, okay, to be honest, but I would say that the legal basis of the regulation is the hard part. I think the regulators would love to regulate that, but it's just what's the legal mechanism to use to regulate it.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, Matt. Well, look, I think it's fascinating this seeing the parallels between these gaming worlds and kind of what we are seeing play out with Bitcoin, maybe slightly higher stakes, but some of the different mechanisms, some of the different trade-offs, some of the mistakes that are made. I mean, I'm imagining Valve are pretty tight-lipped around what they do within this world.
Yes, yes.
You know, they're basically, I mean, they are the central bank of the system, and we know central banking is all about psychology and setting the narrative. And, you know, they had this issue last year where the market tanked, but then they, you know, they've kept the story straight. They haven't flooded the market because, you know, they could, you know, if they were actually selling some of the skins, they could start, you know, there'd be a moral hazard where they're actually the ones printing the skins and then also selling them. But in this case, they are just taking money from the loot boxes.
Yes. I think it's in their best interest to keep this system fair, though. Because as with any sort of, you know, if you're running a financial system, you want it to be long-lasting, I think.
Yeah, and I find it unbelievable that the guy who came up with the system went on to run the Greek economy as a minister of finance.
Yes.
That's just...
From what I heard, like, through Twitter, so basically Valve employs a lot of economists in the company, and they have a lot of data for them to work with.
What's your outlook? You've got a bit of a portfolio with your skins. You've got a few that you're sitting on. You're bullish for the future?
I mean, I'd say in the short term, yes. I don't know anything past short term, but I mean, I don't think with this player base, I mean, 20 million players, I mean, sure, probably like 1 million in the bots, but still, you've got 19 million that are actual players, so it's not going away anytime soon.
And how good of a player are you?
Not that good. I was much better when I was young.
Yeah.
Those reflexes are not here anymore.
Yeah, I think me too. All right, Anthony Lamb, thank you very much.
Thank you, Cody.
Thank you for listening. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.